This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and you've been listening to live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's daily coronavirus briefing from the State House. We have a foreshortened Week in Review coming out of that daily press briefing, but fortunately, our panelists for the Week in Review were both listening and are able to join me now on the line. First, we have Renee Graham of the Boston Globe, a columnist there and a WBUR contributor. Welcome back, Renee.
Thank you.
Also joining us on the line is Ed Lyons. He's a Massachusetts Republican activist and a political writer. Welcome back to you, Ed.
Thanks for having me back.
So I'm glad you both had an opportunity to listen to the governor. There were a number of headlines there. A couple of the key things that I heard, he talked about the surge that he's been anticipating between April 10th and 20th. Probably now, he says, a little closer to April 20th. A lot of data on testing. Positive rate testing rates seem to have been averaging around 30% per day this week. Fatality rate is now up at 2.7%, although that is still below the national average. Not a lot of information about the number of beds available, et cetera. But let's start just by asking each of you to give us sort of your reactions and highlights from the governor just now. Renee, why don't you go first?
I think the thing that jumped out for me was when he mentioned that there were 2,500 positive cases yesterday, and that was the biggest one-day total in the state. You know, I think the reason why he kept drilling down on that and just to let people know, this is not over. You know, you still have to stay at home. You still need to practice social distancing. And above and beyond everything else, just stay home unless you absolutely positively have to be in the street. And I really felt that sort of throughout today's press conference, he really kept trying to drill that home for people. It's not like we're going to have the surge and then it's all going to be great. We can go back to our normal lives. And I think what he's saying is that this is, you know, we're looking at something that's going to be here for the long haul.
Ed, how about you?
Well, I just felt great pride in our state. Just to see the governor, the legislature, and our healthcare community come together like this and prepare for war. And they just seem like that they are ready. And I feel very grateful that they're all doing this.
Listeners, pull up a chair. What were your reactions to the governor's press conference just now? What have you been following this week in the news about the coronavirus here in the Commonwealth? Thoughts, your ideas? Pull up a chair and join us in the conversation. The number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ed and Renee, one of the things that I keyed in on was the governor's reporting on the number of beds that we've got available and how we're scaling up. He says we've got 11,000 beds available between acute care and ICU now, and looking to add another 3,500 fairly quickly. The BCEC Mobile Hospital opened today. Those feel like big numbers, but it's also hard to get my head around what a lot is, because normal, you know, sort of everyday people don't follow our hospital and healthcare capacity in the state. What are your reactions to the size and scale of those numbers?
You know, I think it's interesting. You know, we live in a state that is very much well known for its wonderful medical facilities, and suddenly we're hearing that we might not have enough to get through this. So when you're talking about building field hospitals and needing to get more beds and to get more volunteers and staff into these places, you know, it's sort of sobering to give you an idea of what it's like to even be in an area that is well equipped, but not well equipped enough for a pandemic.
And Ed, he said that right now we're at 55% of our capacity, leaving 45% of the available beds in the Commonwealth for this surge. Does that seem like it will be enough? Do you have some hope that maybe we don't experience, for example, what New York State has experienced?
Well, I think we're learning from what they experienced. And I'm really glad that the governor has changed the conversation from just the spreading and the numbers to, you know, can we take care of the people we need to take care of? I thought he was excellent keeping the focus on the size of our healthcare services. I think it's wonderful that the woman from Boston Medical is talking about serving all groups equally, that having equity. I think a lot of people around the world are going to look back and say, boy, you know, some people suffer from this far more, and that was not what our values were. It seems like Massachusetts is really making sure that the response effort is meeting our values, and I think that was great.
Okay, there's one more thing I want to key in on the debrief of the governor, and then we'll take a quick break and come back. When he was asked towards the end of the brief by a reporter, sort of what are the plans coming out of this, he seemed to get angry and was very clear in an extended and adamant answer that is not the thing to be focusing on right now. That was striking to me in that I couldn't tell if that meant there isn't planning for later going on or if that's just not what he wants to be talking about.
I thought it was what he didn't want to be talking about. I mean, you know, he talked a lot about surge planning and the need to, you know, hope for the best, but plan for the worst. But I don't think we still have a clear sense of what that really means. And I thought that's what the reporter was trying to suss out of the governor, of what does that really mean? And I'm not sure. I think the plans are almost developing day by day, and he didn't have an answer. And so in a somewhat typical way, he got testy in his question, in his answer.
Let's pick up a call. The lines are already full. So let's bring Tricia into the conversation from Arlington. Hi, Tricia.
Hello. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm supporting the governor. Everyone needs to understand distancing is important. I live in the Housing Corporation of Arlington Housing, and there are people here still not abiding by these rules of distancing. There's been company going in and out, and I want to remind all the citizens that we have personal responsibility in this matter.
Thanks for that, Tricia. Let's add one more call. We've got Carol on the line from Norton, Massachusetts. Hi, Carol.
Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to just say, firstly, that I wanted to thank WBUR and also to thank Governor Baker for his fabulous leadership. I had to put today's on mute for a moment, so I'm not sure if he addressed this, but I was calling with a positive story about unemployment. And I know that everybody's been very, very nervous and anxious about getting onto unemployment. I actually experienced a tiny bit of frustration, but after about a week, I was able to apply. But my story is mainly about a callback I got from a guardian angel who works up in the Tingsboro office. I'm not allowed to give out her name, but I'd like to have her recognized eventually. She called me and spent 45 minutes on the phone with me, making sure that everything was just right, answered every single question I had, and told me that I should contact her email if I had any other questions. And I wanted to, mainly in all of these negative stories, I wanted to tell a positive story that on Wednesday, right before my Passover Seder, I was able to sit and enjoy it, of course, remotely, because of this fabulous woman's experience, care, empathy, and guidance.
Thank you for that, Carol. I am a huge fan of the shout-outs, so I don't know who you are in Tingsboro that did such great customer service with Carol.
I am in Norton.
I know. No, I'm saying to the person you're shouting out to, we don't know her name, but she's in Tingsboro, and she did a great job for you, Carol, and we're glad to have it. We did hear, Renee and Ed, from the governor, I believe it was yesterday, that they had returned 60,000 phone calls about unemployment insurance, and we're trying to dial up that customer service. How do we get our head around the amount of customer service response that the government is responsible for in the Commonwealth right now? Ed.
Well, I think we take pride in the state about the safety net we have and serving people. I think this is going to be a great test to say, well, how well are people being served? We you know, if we have these programs, are they being administered properly? There should be some effort to see, you know, are we delivering on our promises to people? I don't know, but I hope we find out more about that.
And Renee, there's such a yin and yang here, because we are hearing some really strong stories about the speed, the rate at which the Commonwealth is scaling up administratively in terms of healthcare capacity, et cetera. We also heard the governor get a question today about the fact that the U.S. Attorney's Office is going to launch its own investigation into the soldiers' home in Holyoke. How and when will we know how well we're doing overall here in the Commonwealth?
I don't think we're going to have a true sense of it until we're on the other side of this, because it's happening in real time. It's hard to, you know, I don't think it's the time for anyone to be patting themselves on the back or you know, doing victory laps. You know, we don't even know if we're near the middle of this thing. So I don't think we're going to have a better sense of how it's all gone until later on. You know, in the same way that we're looking at certain numbers, whether you're talking about number of deaths or The unemployment numbers, we still don't know. We know that the unemployment numbers are probably larger because there's still thousands of people who can't get through in the state, you know, who've given up. So whatever the numbers are, I always say to people, you should probably add maybe another 25 to 50% on top of that, because we still don't know how many people are falling through the cracks because the system wasn't built for this kind of deluge of attention.
All right, Renee Graham of the Boston Globe and Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist. It's Friday, so it's our Week in Review. We actually are foreshortened on the Week in Review today because in the first half of the hour, we brought you live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's daily coronavirus briefing, and we were just debriefing that before the break with our panelists. We have with us still Renee Graham, Boston Globe columnist and a WBUR contributor, and Ed Lyons, a Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. We also have you. Let's take more of your calls. What do you make of this week's news? How are you holding up in this crisis? Where are you finding comfort? How are you feeling about the surge that Governor Baker is now saying, well, it'll still come between April 10th and April 20th, maybe a little closer to April 20th? Call us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Just before the break, Renee, you made a comment about the fact that you tell people whatever the number we think we have is, double it, right, or add another 40 or 50%. I want to pick up on that because I want to start looking at the news of the week now. We're also hearing, we've heard from numerous officials in Chelsea that that city is a new hotspot for the virus. When Mary Lou Sutters was asked at one of the briefings earlier this week where the hotspots were, Chelsea was one that she named. Chelsea's now confirming more than 400 cases there, and some officials are calling for a 24-hour curfew. Here is Chelsea City Council President Roy Avellaneda speaking to WBZ TV about the situation there. Okay, so
higher than New York. What you're not knowing and what we're finding out, and I'm just finding out, is there's a lot of people not being tested, and so it's a lot worse. And so that 400 isn't really a 400 number. It's probably, you know, three times that.
So in a hot spot area like Chelsea, Mary Lou Sutters had also mentioned Brockton and, I believe, Revere. How do we get a sense of the numbers? It's really concerning to have the city council president saying three times that we need to curfew. Ed?
Well, then the Chelsea government can do that. Governor Baker did say that, you know, municipalities, you know, can do more than the state is recommending. So I would hope, I actually know some on the city council in Chelsea. I hope that they get on this, because if things are different there, they should respond differently.
Renee, I want to get some reaction from you to that.
I mean, I think the most obvious thing is we're never going to have a sense of how big this is until testing is available to everyone. Until people can get tests on demand, there's a lot of guesswork in here. You know, what we're hearing about in Chelsea, and it was my Globe colleague, Marcela Garcia, who wrote about this in the column a few days ago, is that you have people who aren't getting the information, who in a lot of cases are in jobs where they can't work at home. So they're still taking mass transit. They're still gathering at bus stops to get to work. They're going out every single day. And meanwhile, they're being told not to. And that's increasing the virus. And we don't know what those numbers really are, because a lot of those people are not in a position to get tested, A, because they don't have the healthcare access to do it, and also because the tests just aren't that readily available.
So I want to stay on this for a minute. The U.S. Census, according to the U.S. Census, about 70% of Chelsea's residents are either self-identified as Hispanic or Latinx. And we are hearing a great deal about racial disparity in COVID-19 around the country. Just from what we know, and we have incomplete numbers here in Boston, more than 40% of those infected here in Boston are Black, even though Black residents make up only about 25% of the population. We're hearing about a hotspot in Chelsea. And just by a point of comparison, about 28% of coronavirus patients in Boston are white, despite making up about 45% of the city's population. We've heard increased conversation this week about the racial disparities. What to make of that? What are your reactions? Renee, I know you wrote about this today.
I did. You know what I said in the column, and I can't reiterate it enough. These numbers are shocking, but they're not at all surprising. There were lots of people, there were lots of advocates, there were lots of Black and Latino doctors who were talking about this as we were starting to move into the pandemic, that this was going to hit vulnerable communities more. And we're seeing exactly what was predicted. So I don't think anyone should be terribly surprised. And it's not that there's a genetic predisposition by, on the part of Black and Latino people to get the virus. It's all the other conditions that exist. The structural racism that has been sustained in this country for decades and really centuries always comes down hardest on the people who are most vulnerable. That's what's happening. So you have people who are in low-income housing, don't have insurance, don't have ready access to medical care, who work in jobs that require that they leave the house, who live in more congested quarters where they're living with more people, they're living in apartment buildings, they're renters. So there's a lot of interaction there outside of a small group of people. So all of those things, which are, again, sustained by racism in this country, are contributing to these really horrific numbers we're seeing in communities of color.
So, Ed, what we have then is a tension that it is centuries of institutionalized racism leading to the disparity that we're experiencing by race in COVID-19 now, and a pandemic that is immediately on us and that we do not have centuries to respond to. So what are the public policy measures that the Commonwealth needs to put in place immediately in order to address the reality of the disparity we're experiencing?
Well, I don't think we can do anything right in the next couple of weeks to address long-term racism, but we actually don't really have all the answers on why we're seeing this disparity. It could be that non-whites live more in dense areas. It could be that they make up a larger percentage of the essential workforce that is still going to work. Perhaps whites are more overrepresented in people who can work from home. I mean, there are clusters of low-income non-whites who live in New Bedford and Fall River, and they're not being racked with this. So I don't think that we have the answers yet. I think it's great that the state is tracking this. I think it's great that we have people in hospitals focusing on equity. I think it's great that the Monica, I think it's about Bartel, the woman who's in charge of the State Public Health Commission. She has a background in serving disadvantaged communities and healthcare. I think a lot of people are working for equity. I think that is the most important thing right now. And then when we have a clearer picture of why this disparity is happening, then we can address that at the other side of the surge.
Monica Burrell there, I just wanted to note. So I want to bring another voice in who also has an opinion. On what needs to happen now. This is Dr. Joseph Betancourt, who was on the show earlier this week, Vice President and Chief of Equity and Inclusion at Massachusetts General Hospital. And he said, we need information and trust.
Information is paramount, and information to our communities is absolutely critical. Ultimately, given our nation's history of racism, discrimination, segregation, medical experimentation, many communities of color have a long history of mistrust, and as a result, they need individuals who they feel are trustworthy, incredible sources of information, and they need to get culturally competent and high quality and respectful care when they come into our healthcare system.
So on this subject, Renee, last word before I go to some callers, where are the trustworthy sources of information right now? Where do people turn?
I think Dr. Fauci is a place to go. But I think that the part of the issue is so often you will hear a political official say, well, for more information, go to cdc.gov. Well, you can only do that if you have access to a computer. There has to be a way. I know the city of Boston has certainly stepped up, and Mayor Walsh has been calling, you know, these sort of automated calls to let people know where services are, to remind people to socially distance and to stay at home. There has to be a way, and they have it in multiple languages, which is also very important because there are parts of the Commonwealth where there are not English speakers, and they're still going to be affected, and they shouldn't be punished because they don't speak English. They need this information. They need to know how to take care of themselves and their family. So I think there are ways that they're trying to do that. There just needs to be much more of it. You can't just have it as, you know, log on and find it, because not everyone can do that. That's what we found with the stay-at-home orders. Not everyone could stay at home because they didn't have the technology to allow them to do that. I think that there has to be an increased and concerted effort on the part of state and city officials to get the message out there to all parts of the Commonwealth, not just to the people who would normally get it.
All right, let's pick up some calls. We've got Kelly on the line from Uxbridge, Massachusetts. Hey, Kelly, what's on your mind?
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to comment just on, well, I want to commend Governor Baker for standing in front of us every day and passing on the information, the data, the facts. out to the community. I'm sure that he and local government, as well as healthcare workers, everybody is just exhausted with this because it's a day in, day out thing that we are dealing with. But one of the comments that I had is in regards to some of the small town communities. I'm seeing almost on a daily basis comments being circulated around social media where people are still not really taking this very seriously. And it's disheartening to see the comments that are rolling in of people who are saying they're still going to have their backyard barbecues and they're still going to get together, and that, you know, this in a small town where there are, I think, 13 cases right now, it's not even, you know, you can't even compare to some of the hot spots in the cities. People are just taking this too lightly, I think. And I hope in hearing him answer that question, I could feel that energy in his voice. I could sense his, you know, the sternness, and, you know, he sounded almost angry at that question, what the woman asked, when are we going to get back to, when are we
Kelly,
going
to I am
up
so and- sorry to interrupt you, but I want to make sure to be able to get a couple other caller voices in here, too. I think we've got the idea there, and I appreciate you calling in with that frustration about communities that are still not taking the social distancing seriously. Let's get one other call in. At least we've got Robert from Townsend. Robert, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. What I've been paying attention to this week is the fact that other countries are knocking down this infection spread by requiring, or at least encouraging everyone to wear a cloth mask. We're talking about people who have to live close quarters or have to go, you know, out and work in essential jobs. And if people would just assume that they could be a carrier and wear a cloth mask, it could cut down transmission a great deal.
Thank you for that,
people,
Robert.
Have to learn to,
and I will say the Surgeon General has a good instruction video out there, 30 seconds to make a cloth mask. I've tried it. I wore it today when I got to the office, and it totally works. So you can check out the Surgeon General on that. Renee and Ed, we've got about 2 minutes left, and there's so much left to talk about. But I think where I want to go next is to just ask each of you, what is the story right now? Where are we in the Commonwealth on the pandemic, and what should everybody be thinking about and focusing on right now? Ed?
I think we should listen to what Governor Baker said, that it's time to focus on the problems in front of us, and that by staying home and following the guidelines is the most important thing we can do. Even though Easter and Passover are coming, and I thought it was great you talked about faith, that it's important to do the right thing as individuals, and that will make the whole system work better. That's what we should be focusing on.
Renee, how about you? What do you think?
I think it's the same thing. I think, you know, worry less about when you can get back to your parties and when you can go out to the theater, and think about what you can do to get through this situation safety and sanity. You have to take care of yourselves and take care of your neighbors. And the only way to do that is through social distancing and staying at home.
And so we've got about 35 seconds left now. So what will it take till everybody reads the urgency of this situation the same? Both of you.
I don't know. I mean, I think there are always going to be people who think it's an exaggeration. I think that there's this sort of dissonance that's happening between, say, Massachusetts and a state like Mississippi, where, you know, things are still going on and people are still packing churches. I think there almost has to be a national effort. I don't know, maybe declaration of a national stay-at-home order, which has not been forthcoming, to maybe convince the most recalcitrant people that they need to do more.
And Ed?
We don't need everyone to do this. We need almost everyone to do this. And we have to try as hard as we can. We should not. Humanity is a messy business. Let's just try to do as much as we can.
All right. That's Ed Lyons. He's a Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Thanks, Ed.
Thank you.
And Renee Graham, Boston Globe columnist and a WBUR contributor. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. That is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director, with engineering today by Glenn Alexander. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering, and I do hope you will join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.